Welcome to Beyond from YVR, the Vancouver International Airport. I'm your host, Tamara Vrooman, President and CEO of YVR. We're privileged to be located on Sea Island, the traditional and unceded territory of the Musqueam people. And I'd like to take a moment to pay my respects to elders past and present. We're here to go beyond polarized debates, beyond the obvious, and of course, beyond the pandemic and its negative implications. We're bringing in special guests all season to help us go beyond and think about new ways of doing things. On today's episode of Beyond, we're talking to Zipporah Berman. Zipporah is a co-founder of Stand.Earth, an organization dedicated to challenging corporations and government to treat people and the environment with respect. She has been designing environmental campaigns and working on environmental policy in Canada and beyond for over 30 years. She is currently the chair of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative, an adjunct professor of York University Faculty of Environmental Studies, and the co-founder of the Globe Gas and Oil Network. She was also recently a guest speaker at COP26, the United Nations Climate Change Conference. In 2021, she was arrested for blockading the logging of 1,000-year-old trees in Fairy Creek on Vancouver Island here in British Columbia. And she gave a widely viewed TED Talk, now at over 1.5 million views, presenting the case for a global treaty to phase out fossil fuels. Today, we're going to talk to Zipporah about her 30-year career on the front lines of the climate crisis and how corporations, governments, and citizens can adapt to a changing world. Zipporah, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So Zipporah, your career has been so far-reaching and wide-ranging. You've been an advocate, a researcher for justice and for the climate change movement for over 3 decades. So tell me a little bit about the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. That's a mouthful when I say it that way, but I'm sure you can tell our audience a little bit. So what does it actually mean?
The reason we called it the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty is because we modeled the treaty on the 3 pillars of nuclear non-proliferation. Decades ago, you know, when I was a child, we had reports that talked about the greatest and most likely threat to global security. That was nuclear weapons. And in the last decade, really in the last 5 years, if you look at the World Economic Forum reports, which do address the greatest threats to global security, the greatest threat to global security today is failure to mitigate climate change. It's the greatest impact. It's the greatest threat. And so the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was a treaty designed to stop the expansion because we already have enough fossil fuels that if we burn what we have, it'll take us well beyond 2 degrees. So we're spending our financial, our intellectual, and our political capital right now to dig up stuff that we can't burn, instead of focusing that time and money and effort on building cleaner and safer renewable energy systems, which we can now do at scale and in almost every country in the world, large-scale solar, wind, geothermal. They're cheaper now than fossil fuels. And so we designed the treaty based on 3 pillars. Stop the expansion. So no new. Manage the stockpile, wind it down, and ensure that that managed wind down is based on equity. So who gets to produce and how much shouldn't be decided by the markets. I mean, literally right now, the markets are deciding the fate of humanity. The markets, based on price and demand, decide how much we build and burn. And so the treaty is designed so that governments will start to negotiate based on principles of equity and help to problem solve. There are some countries right now drilling for new oil, Ecuador, in the heart of the Amazon, in literally next to uncontacted peoples, in indigenous lands where people still live in that rainforest and are opposed to the drilling. They're drilling for new oil just to feed their debt. And it is actually opposed to a lot of Ecuador's policies on human rights and on climate change and on biodiversity. So we're going to need debt negotiations that reflect the science of climate change and of carbon. We're going to need a lot of these other agreements. So the second pillar is around managing the wind down. And then the third pillar is around fast-tracking solutions. So we need to ensure that the wealthy countries, for example, put money on the table So emerging economies can leapfrog over the fossil fuel era and just start to build now the electrification infrastructure and renewable infrastructure that they need to turn the lights on for millions of people that currently live in energy poverty.
So certainly the treaty, as you describe it, really envisions a coordinated and collective systemic approach to climate, because, of course, it is one planet, no matter where the countries are located. So who has signed on to the treaty? What's been the response to the treaty so far?
The treaty initiative has only been live for a little more than a year. And we started, similar to the landmine treaty and the nuclear treaty, by going to scientists, by going to opinion leaders, and also cities to kind of build momentum to get nation states to take the concept seriously. And we've had, honestly, a lot more success than we thought we would in the first year. It took off like a rocket, I think, because people are looking for bold new ideas to solve this crisis. We can't keep doing what we've been doing. It's not working. And so we have 101 Nobel laureates, including the Dalai Lama, has already endorsed the concepts of the treaty. We have 2,800 scientists and academics from around the world who have endorsed the treaty. Parliamentarians, so not whole countries yet, but parliamentarians, elected officials from 33 countries, 180 parliamentarians have signed on, and that number is changing every day. 11 from Canada, I noticed, from three different political parties, and two senators have endorsed the fossil fuel treaty. And also civil society groups. We now have over 1,000 civil society groups in almost every region of the world who have endorsed the treaty and are starting to plan campaigns. Just last month, COICA, the Federation of Indigenous Nations, including all 8 Amazon nations, as well as Amnesty International, many other organizations have signed on and are starting to plan civil society campaigns. But I think some of the greatest movement has come from cities. Vancouver was the first city in the world to pass a motion at council endorsing the fossil fuel treaty, and it was endorsed unanimously, followed not long after by Toronto. So we now have 36 cities, I think. There'll be a new big one announced in the next couple of months. But just this month, we had Amsterdam join up and many other cities. People can see the lists of everyone who's endorsed at fossilfueltreaty.org. So the momentum is big. And we're in private conversations now with several nation states. I think before the end of 2022, we're going to start to see countries start to put this on the floor of the UN.
And that's quite an impressive amount of momentum in a short period of time. As you said, right across the board, from civil society to cities, our own city here in Vancouver, to parliamentarians, and to, of course, scientists. But I wonder if you think that people would find it interesting that we're having this conversation about climate energy on a podcast that is being produced by an airport. We know that flying, the aviation industry, has a large carbon footprint. Why do you think it's important for organizations like YVR and for the private sector in sectors like the aviation industry to engage in this topic?
Well, first of all, I think it's critical for everyone to engage in this topic. You know, when I started working on environmental issues 30 years ago, it was because I had a softness for big trees and bears. You know, I love our forests in Canada, and that's what drew me to these issues. But I think today you can't consider them environmental issues. These are economic issues. These are the moral issues of our age. They're social justice issues. They affect the kind of world our kids are going to grow up in. And we had a taste of it in BC in the last year. The floods, the fires, the heat dome, terrifying. I have 2 boys in university, and they frequently talk to me about whether they should be studying these things that they're interested in, or whether they should just be going to work for the Red Cross or getting more skills in trade, and whether it makes sense, for example, to study the arts or literature anymore in the world that they're living in. I find that heartbreaking. But it's realistic if you're looking at what our world is facing if we don't act now. And so I think every corporation, I think every person has a role to play, but sectors like aviation have an outsized role to play, simply because these are complicated issues. But again, what's not complicated is that they're primarily coming from 3 products. And oil and gas is something that is used considerably by the aviation industry. And I think for too long, the focus has been put on individuals, on the choices we make, and not sectors. The time that we have is short. Our governments have committed to reduce emissions by 40% by 2030, to go net zero, so to get to zero and beyond in fossil fuel emissions by 2050. 2030 is only 8 years away. And so that's going to require major action by corporations and whole sectors. And at these critical moments in our history, leadership matters. A lot of people don't know the story of how we healed the hole in the ozone layer, but it's one of the greatest environmental victories of all time.
So tell me that story.
Well, we did it because of Canada. You know, Canada played a huge, outsized role in pushing for the Montreal Protocol. We banned CFCs. We put in place agreements, international agreements, and cooperation to address that crisis. And we healed the holes in the ozone layer. It's an incredible story of international cooperation. But as a Canadian, I love that story because I know from talking to people who negotiated it that Canada played a huge role by showing that leadership, by stepping up. And, you know, I've studied social change now my whole life and trying to understand what makes change happen. And what I've learned is that social change isn't linear. It happens at tipping point moments because of technological change or financial change, policy change. But when you go to the root of any of those, it happens because of leadership. It happens because people step up and they take a stand, and sometimes it's a difficult stand, but it inspires other people to do it too. So what YVR does on climate change could inspire other airports. The positions that you take on climate change could affect all the different carriers that come into YVR and what they decide to do on climate change. I think of it as the pebble that drops in the pond and the ripples out. We all have the capacity in our communities, in our businesses, in our sectors to be that pebble in the pond. And that's what this moment calls for.
It certainly does. And here at YVR, as I think you know, we have made a commitment to be net zero by 2030. And we've not just made a commitment, we've actually published an action-based roadmap to get us there, the first airport in North America to do that. And we certainly are going to work to do it even sooner. And while I agree that leadership among organizations and corporations is where this change happens, I'm also personally motivated to take those steps when I look at the youth in our community. I also have a son in university who asked me those same questions. I look at the young people who work at our airport, who love the aviation industry, but they worry, frankly, about what it does to climate, particularly given the events that we've seen here in British Columbia over the last 12 months. And they want to be part of an industry that serves a need. We are a country with a large geography and a small population, so a healthy aviation sector is important. But they want us to do it responsibly, and they want us to do our part and then some, to lead as we have in so many other areas in the area of climate.
Of course. And I mean, you're sitting at the nexus of one of the really intransigent problems. We don't have a solution for aviation that completely gets rid of fossil fuels. Not today. And, you know, much of our lives, a lot of our lives and our and the way that systems work are still dependent on flying.
What do you say to people who, you spoke about them earlier, whose livelihoods and families really depend on the energy sector here in Canada? And the science shows that future is not bright from a growth and an economics point of view, but yet the transition and the economic adjustment that's needed to wean ourselves off fossil fuels as a country is quite significant. How do we start to mobilize pathways for those who are working in the sector?
I think it's a little bit like staring into the sun. We have to acknowledge what needs to happen in order to create a plan to manage the wind down of production. And without actually saying it out loud, you know, I was at a conference a couple of years ago with a lot of people from Ottawa, a lot of elected officials and folks from the Prime Minister's office. And someone turned to me and said, you know, it's rude how you keep bringing up fossil fuels. It was a climate change conference. And they said, if you keep talking about how we need to reduce the amount that we produce of oil and gas, then you're just going to lose your access and people aren't going to want to talk to you because it's kind of rude. But I know Canadians are polite and we like to have a balance, we like to not fight, all of these things. But if we don't actually acknowledge the fact that we have to wind down production, then we're making it more difficult every day by growing the problem. The workers and their families are more at risk from us not talking about it and not acting than they are from us actually facing it and acting. Because this is an industry that is characterized by boom and bust moments. And we've seen it a number of times when the price collapses and people are thrown out of work. And so right now there's a high price and Premier Kenney's arguing to build more pipelines and expand. If we double down when the boom leaves, which we know it will, because there are 35 countries in the world that have already set a date for when they're going to ban the fossil fuel car. All of the projections on oil demand show that it's going to peak and decline within the next 8 years. We know that the world is going to use less oil. So we have to stop scrabbling and trying to pretend that we're going to be the last barrel sold. Canada will not be the last barrel sold. We have some of the most expensive oil and gas in the world, and we have some of the dirtiest and high-carbon oil and gas in the world. And so every major financial and economic analysis on energy systems globally has said that, no, Canada will not be the last barrel sold. So we need to plan for it. And by planning for it, then we assure that no one's going to be left behind in the transition. And it's going to cost us less. Every day that we wait, it costs us more.
You're listening to Beyond, a podcast from Vancouver International Airport. I'm your host, Tamara Vrooman. Our guest today is Zipporah Berman. Zipporah is a prominent climate activist challenging governments and corporations around the world to take action on one of the most pressing issues of our time. She joins us today to talk about the change she's seen in conversations around climate change over the last few decades and the future of climate action. So we're sitting here at YVR. Our purpose is to serve the community and the economy that supports it by moving people and goods to where they need to be moved, largely through flying. We also know that flying is, at its core, a fossil fuel intensive activity. So what are some of the thoughts that you have about what we can be doing and what we should be thinking about as an airport as we try and tackle our responsibilities vis-a-vis climate?
I've been really thinking about what we've learned during the pandemic. I mean, during the pandemic, reduced air travel had very little and almost no impact on productivity, according to a number of polls that were published. And many people even said it has had a positive impact. I think a lot about the business sector because it's such a huge component of aviation. And flying less for business, I think, needs to be part of the new normal. So I don't know, as the CEO of an airport, how you address that, but I feel like business travel is a huge part of the problem. So until we get truly sustainable ways to fly, our solution for today needs to be in part in flying less. And, you know, could YVR be leading in positioning the airport to adapt to that trend for business to fly less? There are probably a number of things that the carriers who come into this airport could do around collaborating to make their routes more efficient, to make the travel more efficient as well. So I think all of that needs to be explored because there's sometimes when you just have to get on a plane. You have a family member, there's a family thing, I think of it as love miles. You have a work opportunity which has to be face-to-face. I can't negotiate a global treaty if I can't sit down with the Minister of Environment from a certain country at a United Nations conference. I really can't. But most of the travel I do, I probably don't have to get on a plane. So how does an airport, or can an airport, help people think about flying less or plan for less flying? Infrastructure really matters.
We certainly have seen in the pandemic that there has been a reduction in all flying. Of course, we're only at about a third of the passenger volume that we would have had pre-pandemic, even up until
at this point.
Yeah. And business travel, I think many of us think business travel is not going to return in the way because we've learned that we can do some things, although, as you correctly say, not everything can be done virtually, but certainly more than I think we thought possible. And then I think it's quite important that we preserve aviation for where it's needed most. So absolutely, friends and family, to study abroad, international students and people going to have lived experience, educational experiences in other places. We know that also cargo is an important part. Every vaccine that came into our province during the pandemic came in by air because it needed to get here in a certain condition at a certain time. So we need a healthy aviation sector, and we need to find ways of connecting where there's a good alternative to a shorter flight. Are there opportunities for electric-powered aircraft, as we've seen with float planes and Harbor Air? Is there an opportunity to connect with multimodal, with passenger trains and high-speed rail? Is there a way to connect cargo to battery-operated marine and barge infrastructure that allows us to electrify the supply chain? You know, we think about an airport a lot as the movement of people, and it certainly is, but it increasingly, cargo volumes have actually gone up during the pandemic as we've all got used to clicking and ordering and thinking about supply chains and how to really make supply chains efficient, but also green and carbon efficient is definitely a challenge because we've got used to moving things back and forth across the planet several times to actually build and create them.
You know, as you talk about that, it makes me think how important it is to have collaboration between sectors. You know, aviation is 2% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Is it fashion industry, if it were a country, would be one at the top, right? The fashion industry, the apparel industry alone is 6%, I understand, of global emissions. And there's a lot of goods moving around the world there as well. And if we could have some more collaboration between the different levels of the supply chain to make it more efficient and less carbon intensive, that would be huge as well.
Well, the good news about supply chains, and there's some really interesting work happening to create so-called transparent supply chains, so really being able to see end to end. But the good news about supply chain is when we reduce energy, we also reduce cost. And so there's no trade-off between more efficient and less carbon intensive in a supply chain environment. Our biggest challenge is having transparency and really understanding how, say, a single shirt starts with the organic material and ends on the store shelf somewhere else many months later.
That's really interesting. And, you know, I think I would be really interested. Then again, I'm a bit of a geek on these things, but I think other people would be interested too in the numbers around the airport. Like how many people go through are just coming for pleasure? How many are business? How much of these planes are filled with cargo? And some of the statistics around your reduction of your carbon footprint. I was excited to see the battery operated, what are those things called that go out to the plane?
The bridges.
The bridges, yes. The battery operated bridges that we can see out the windows here at YVR. So yeah, I agree. Transparency and accountability is essential because the other thing is sometimes we miss things and other people can look at the data and go, well, wait a minute, why aren't we acting over here? So.
You know, I feel a real commitment and responsibility for the over 25,000 people who work at this airport in terms of the future, which is, of course, one of the reasons that we've taken such a leadership position to do our part going forward. But, you know, listening to you, Zipporah, it's full of promise in terms of the change that we need to make, but also it's pretty dire, the consequences if we don't. And certainly as I look around the community, I see climate anxiety, mental health, where do we start, the problem's too hard, becoming a real issue for individuals in our community. What are you seeing in terms of how climate anxiety, even as a topic, is becoming very endemic in our communities?
It's incredibly pervasive. When you read the trends, climate psychology, you talk to therapists, you look at the polling and focus groups, it has escalated dramatically in the last 2 years. And I think in part it's coming from the fact that more and more people around the world are now experiencing the impacts of climate change in their daily lives. I mean, here in British Columbia, I will never forget the day that Lytton burst into flames. I'll never forget panicking and running around calling hotels to try and find places for seniors and elders I knew in the heat dome who were struggling. 600 people died in BC in a week last summer during the heat dome. So we're living it. And of course, that's going to make people anxious. And what makes us more anxious is the fact that there's such a disconnect between the science and what we're living and the way that our decision makers are acting. So if it's an emergency, you act like you did in the pandemic. Every day, you look at whether we're bending the curve. Every day, you talk to the public and talk about what you're doing. You make sure that it's not a line item in your budget. It's every item in your budget. Climate change is not one issue now that can be one line item. Every single ministry, every single department, every single corporation needs to be looking at what it means for their budget, what it means for their communications. If we're not being honest with the public about what we're facing, then that's when you see all this anxiety, because people aren't stupid. They can read the science. Everyone can see it. So you hear a report about how fires are increasing and species are going extinct and we're going to be facing more flooding. And then everyone acts like it's normal. And it's that disconnect that I think you see in climate psychology that people are really reacting to. It's not knowing what to do, and it's feeling powerless in the face of such dramatic change. So it's why some people, like Seth Klein in his amazing book, The Good War, he talks about the mobilizations around World War II, where it was, we're all in this together, all hands on deck. Let's retool our factories. What can the average person do? The government's creating programs. And he talks about what that would look like as a climate mobilization. I think about that a lot. My kids want to join a Green Corps. You know, we want to commit our household to doing X, Y, and Z for climate refugees. People want to act, but they don't know what to do other than save up for an electric car and ride to work, recycle. And those actions feel so paltry. It's a disconnect with what we're actually facing that it leaves us anxious.
Mm. It's true, isn't it? I remember my grandmother speaking about victory gardens and things that everybody did in their everyday life, including and up to what the leaders in our country at the time, like C.D. Howe and others, came out of the private sector in order to mobilize for the war effort. So we definitely have that potential, I agree, among us. And so speaking of potential, with all of the challenge that you see, what gives you hope?
Every day, I think about what I can do in order to remain hopeful. Hope isn't something you have. It's something we create. There's an old saying, action is the antidote to despair. I live that every day. I read climate science every day. It is overwhelming. I once heard Barbara Kingsolver say in an interview on climate change, and this is a decade ago, she said, every day I put on hope like a sweater and I think about what I'm going to do. And so that's what I do. That's for me what hope is. When I'm working together on a new plan with a group of people like the Fossil Fuel Treaty and being able to see the more people signing on every day and the progress, that just gives me hope. When I'm at a rally or in Ferry Creek getting arrested, blockading the old growth, and I'm linking arms with this woman who's a farmer in Cowichan Valley and a scientist on my left and never met them before that day, and there we are getting arrested together. Just seeing that they're there and they're making the effort, meeting those people on, you know, in the rallies and the protests, that gives me hope to know that I'm not alone and there are other people who feel as strongly as I do.
Mm. That really resonates, you know, what we've been talking about here today, the tremendous challenges that we have. But above all else, the fact that we have the ability to solve this, but we have to work together. There's no question. There's no part of what you outlined in the treaty there that doesn't affect every aspect of our lives, of our decision-making, of our governments, of our regulation, of the way that we see the planet, and the way that we mobilize as business, community, and even just individuals. So, Zipporah, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today. You're a wealth of knowledge, a true, true gift in our country around this topic. What would you want to say to a young person who's listening to us talking about this, who loves working at the airport, who knows that we're part of a fossil fuel industry, but yet has chosen aviation because they want to be part of the solution in the future.
I would say push for change. That we have to think about what we do as individuals, how much we fly. I know I struggle with that. And I call it work miles and love miles. I'm allowed some work miles and some love miles, and to see my family and things that I have to do for work. But I've probably reduced my travel by about 70% now. We all have to do what we can in our lives, in our own personal lives. But if you're working here in the aviation sector, you also can create change by pushing the dialogue, pushing decision makers in the sector to be more ambitious, to really put money towards researching alternatives and plans and making those plans, creating the hard conversations. These are hard conversations. And regardless of what level you work in the sector or in a company, you can help create those conversations. Don't wait and expect that experts should do it, because we all need to step up into that conversation today.
One of the things I love about aviation is that it is, at its very core, a future-focused type of sector. And I think the idea that people who work in it can be the ones that push leaders, including myself, for change is an excellent note to end on. So, Zipporah, thank you very much for sharing the tremendous work that you've been doing, not only here in Canada, but right around the world. It's been a true pleasure to hear from you today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again to our guest today, Zipporah Berman. Remember to follow Beyond in your favorite podcast app for more conversations, diverse perspectives, and ideas about how we can all go beyond. A note for our listeners, we're going to be taking a mid-season break due to the ever-evolving situation with COVID-19, travel guidelines, and many other factors that affect our industry. Please continue to follow the show, as new episodes will be coming out shortly. Until then, thanks for listening. This show is brought to you by YVR. The show producer is Nathan Atnikoff. Editing by Diego Domine, with audio production by Jar Audio.